The city of Tokyo isn't running out of money, but it's running out of patience. For 8 years, it's been waging war on its crows. The campaign reportedly began after a crow buzzed Tokyo's governor as he played golf, prompting a declaration that he would turn crow meat pies into Tokyo's favorite dish. Well, that hasn't happened, but the battle continues today with mixed results, as NPR's Louisa Lim found out on a recent trip to Tokyo.
This is the sound that makes Yumiko Kono's heart beat faster as she pounds around Yoyogi Park in central Tokyo. She's a long-distance runner who covers at least 7 miles a day. She's highly sensitive to sound since she's blind. She runs with the aid of a companion. A year and a half ago, she was attacked by a crow in the park, an experience that has traumatized her.
A crow landed on my head just for an instant while I was running. It was like it was using my head as a jumping board. I was surprised, then scared. Now when I hear crows cawing and their wings flapping, I still get scared.
She's not alone. Many Tokyo dwellers have been dive-bombed by the big black jungle crows that flap around the city. Everyone knows someone who's been pecked or pooped upon. For Alfred Hitchcock fans, it's eerily reminiscent of his thriller, The Birds.
I mean, birds just don't go around attacking people without no reason, you know what I mean? Kids probably scared them, that's all.
These birds attacked.
In that movie, flocks of birds victimized one small town, with hundreds of crows attacking the local school children. In Tokyo, it's not that bad yet. But the big black bullies do cause technological havoc. They nest in utility poles and cause blackouts. They even steal fiber-optic cables to build nests, sometimes disabling parts of the broadband network. Tokyo's crow czar, Toshimasa Uno, admits crow numbers are on the up. He blames commuter crows, who fly in to feast on the capital's garbage.
The crow number increased by 16% from the year before. We think the reason is that crows fly into Tokyo from the suburbs.
He says the corvine population now stands or flies at an estimated 21,200. That's despite millions of dollars spent on the war on crows.
The crow budget for 2009 was about $700,000. The year before, it worked out to around $50 for every crow killed. But we have to spend this money because people are complaining.
We're here with park manager Koji Takagi, and we're picking our way amongst the greenery, and we're going to see the crow traps the government's been using to try to battle the crows.
Most of the crows we catch with this trap are young ones that are inexperienced, but it's good to catch the young ones so they can't breed and increase the number of crows.
Back in Yoyogi Park, birds are thrashing around inside the traps, which are enormous cages 10 by 20 feet, open in the middle. The crows are lured in by lard smeared on the ground. Once in, hanging spikes stop them from flying out. Park manager Takagi says every 3 days, the trapped crows are taken away to be gassed.
We do get complaints from people opposed to the crow extermination, but this is the policy of the Environment Bureau. People should also learn to deal with garbage better.
So we're now going to see a very unusual project here in central Tokyo, in the swanky shopping district of Ginza. That buzzing noise that you can probably hear is 300,000 honeybees that are being kept in beehives right in the center of Tokyo. And Atsuo Tanaka, the co-founder of the Ginza Honeybee Project, says this project is actually helping keep the crows away.
The bees become very aggressive when they see shiny black objects because it reminds them of bears or hornets that might attack them. So whenever they see crows, a whole swarm of bees will chase them.
And although the honeybees chase away the black marauders, they're surprisingly friendly to humans.
You try it?
You want me to touch those honeybees?
Yes.
Will they bite me?
Yes, okay. No.
Okay, I'm very nervous. I'm actually touching the back of the honeybees. They are. It's really soft.
This may be an eco-friendly solution, and one which provides honey into the bargain. But so far, it's unproven and impractical on a larger scale. The battle of birds and bees seems almost surprising in the setting of Tokyo's high-tech urban jungle. But the war on crows underlines that finding the right balance between man and nature isn't easy, even in a city. Louisa Lim, NPR News.
Scientists say crows can also hold grudges, even retaliate against people. Get that part of the story at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. There are some things that many of us do not do, even though they would save us money, like switch to compact fluorescent light bulbs or buy a new energy-efficient refrigerator or just turn off the lights in an empty room. It's as if we like wasting money. Now, that's not true, of course, but it is a hard problem to fix. NPR's David Kestenbaum from our Planet Money team has more.
Dan Riker thinks he knows the solution. Every family just needs to attach this little device to the fuse box in their house. His family did it a few months ago. The device is pretty simple. It just measures the amount of electricity used in the house. He can see the information on a meter in his kitchen or online.
And every time I go to Google something, or look at the weather or sports or the stocks, there sits my electricity use in real time.
Can you show me right now?
Yeah. Let's see. I'll look back.
I need to mention that Dan Riker works for Google, which wrote the piece of software he's using. It's his job to show this stuff off. We met at the climate change talks in Copenhagen, where it was often pointed out that conservation, energy efficiency improvements, those are the easiest ways to begin to combat global warming. Riker thinks there's a simple reason we don't do these things. We lack information. On a laptop, he pulls up the information, a very detailed graph. You can see exactly when his family wakes up, because the line goes up. The kids turn the lights on, his wife uses her hairdryer. Then there's this other huge spike.
My six-year-old son saw this the other day, and it finally dawned on him. He was looking at our little meter, which normally is at 200 watts, and this thing shoots up to 1,800 watts. He said, "Daddy, look!" And it was simply the toaster, you know, turning electrical energy into massive heat energy to singe this toast.
Every bump or mountain on the chart was a mystery. And he found some easy things he could do to save money.
I kept seeing this big spike, and I began to suspect it was my furnace. So I had my son go in the living room and turn the furnace off using the thermostat, and all of a sudden, within a couple of seconds, I saw this peak just drop precipitously.
It turned out his furnace had a really old, inefficient motor, the thing that blows the heat around the house. So he replaced it. He also got a new refrigerator, which eventually will save him some money. Dan Riker was an assistant secretary at the Energy Department under President Clinton. He and people like him argue if we just had more information, we'll save money and we'll be better people and we'll help the environment.
So at a very general level, we think knowledge is power. And indeed, in this case, knowledge is less power.
Who wrote that line? You wrote that line?
You could send me to the penitentiary.
It is true that right now, electricity is kind of a weird commodity. People just get their monthly bill. They don't know what it's costing what.
Imagine going into a grocery store and there were no prices on anything. You simply put it in your basket and at the end of the month you got a bill, you know, pay $671.15. I don't think most people would stand for that.
But there is debate about what effect these so-called smart meters would have. George Lowenstein is a behavioral economist at Carnegie Mellon University.
In fact, some of the information that a smart meter would give you might actually worsen your behavior because, for example, electricity is really amazingly cheap. It's amazingly cheap to air condition your whole house for a few hours. And if the smart meter is giving you objective information about how much it's costing you, you might be surprised at how cheap it is rather than surprised at how expensive it is.
Lowenstein says there are a lot of tests going on right now to assess the effect of putting in different kinds of smart meters. Some will do the thinking for you.
Like they shut down your air conditioning at a peak time. And there is some research showing that people are surprisingly willing to go along with something like that.
And that may be the most productive approach, he says. Let the machines make our economic decisions for us. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In large parts of the Middle East, for 3 years now, a drought has devastated farm and grazing land. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. Yesterday, we heard about some of those water refugees in Syria. Today, NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Turkey, where the country's control over water has brought privileges and distrust.
I'm on a small fishing boat on the waters of the Bosphorus. It's one of the busiest shipping lanes for oil transport in the world. More than a dozen tankers are on the horizon, but none of this oil comes from Turkey. The resource that counts here is water. Turkey is one of the only countries in the region to have enough water for its population.
The Arabs, the Iraqis and the Syrians, feel very much that Turkey is asserting itself as a regional hydrological superpower.
That's Hussein Amri, a water specialist at the Colorado School of Mines. Turkey is a water superpower, he says, because the headwaters of the great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, are in the Turkish mountains. Over the years, the Turks have built dozens of dams, limiting the flow to the Arab world downstream. The severe drought in Syria and Iraq, says Amri, has fueled resentment against the Turks.
Something like 160 villages in Syria between 2007 and 2008 were totally depopulated. I know also of scores and scores of villages that have been depopulated in Iraq as well. Crops were not growing, cattle were dying, and their source of livelihood just sort of ceased to be.
In Turkey, Gün Kut, a water expert, expresses an often heard criticism in response to Arab complaints.
Quit wasting the water and there will be enough for everybody.
Kut says outdated farming techniques and even worse water management waste a dwindling resource.
Simply insisting on others to release more and more and more water while the population is going up, the need for food is going up, won't work. It won't work. If they have all the water, it won't work.
Here in southeast Turkey, the Euphrates River is clear, blue, and deep. The Atatürk Dam harnesses water for one of the biggest irrigation and electric power schemes in the world. It's known as the Southeastern Anatolia Project, a multi-billion dollar project to generate opportunities for Turkey. At the inauguration, more than a decade ago, then-President Süleyman Demirel said neither Syria nor Iraq could lay claim to Turkey's water any more than Turkey could claim Arab oil. While Turkey's position has softened since then, former diplomat Faruk Loğlu says that statement has caused tension for years.
Turkey, in my judgment, properly claims that these waters originate in Turkey, and we have the first say.
They have oil. We don't have oil. They have the capital. They should invest.
Invest in water efficiency, says Gün Kut. More important, sign on to a regional management of the Euphrates and the Tigris as if the borders didn't exist. Turkey has renewed this proposal at a time when relations with Arab neighbors are improving. At the same time, this drought threatens the stability of Iraq and Syria, says Josh Landis, an American academic who writes an influential blog on Syria.
How a little country like Syria, which is badly run economically, is coming out of a socialist past, is trying to liberalize, is going to be able to provide water to all of its people, is a mystery.
There was a time that the Ottoman Empire controlled the waters of the Tigris and the Euphrates. These days, hawkers sell wooden flutes outside the palaces, which are now museums, as well as a monument to the 800-year empire. Turkey's aggressive outreach to the Arab Middle East is sometimes called neo-Ottomanism. The new approach includes binding neighbors together through commercial ties, gas and oil pipelines, and a shared electric grid. And finally, it seems, after years of tension, there are signs of agreement on regional water, says Hussein Amri.
I would tell the Syrians, Turks, and Iraqis to get together, cooperate in managing the Tigris and Euphrates as one ecosystem that it is. It requires a new way of thinking about farming and irrigation.
This week, Turkey and Syria agreed to joint management of some water resources after being at odds for years. In the past, Iraq and Syria have threatened war over water. Now, the region is warming. The population is growing.
a massive water shortage could be devastating. Deborah Amos, NPR News.
Have you ever heard of fracking? Fracking, it's short for hydraulic fracturing, and it's a process that blasts water, sand, and chemicals into underground rock deposits to release natural gas. And fracking has mostly been used in the western United States, but new discoveries of gas-rich rock in a formation called the Marcellus Shale, which stretches from New York down through Pennsylvania into West Virginia, could mean a lot more fracking in a lot more places, and it has created quite a controversy. Some people are worried about what fracking can do to groundwater or what to do with the wastewater that it is produced. Does it find its way? Are there spills on the drilling sites into streams and places like that? What does it do to the wildlife in those areas? That's what we'll be talking about this hour, the progress and the politics of the process. And my guests are Gwen Latdahl. She is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, and she joins us from Durango, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Kathleen Skama is the director of government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States in Denver. And thank you for being with us today, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Tell us how fracking is done.
Well, we drill a well for natural gas or oil, and we drill down several thousand feet into a source rock layer containing natural gas or oil, and we may drill horizontally through that rock layer. And because of the intense pressure and because of the depth that we're drilling at, it's not easy for the natural gas to flow from that source rock into the wellbore. So we do a process called hydraulic fracture stimulation, whereby we pump water and sand and some chemicals, a mixture of those, down in through the wellbore and into down below ground into the source rock, and literally try to crack that open. And, you know, we're lucky if we can get some horizontal cracks about, a few hundred feet out if we're lucky because of the intense pressure. But it's important to note that before we do that fracturing process, we've cemented and cased that wellbore. So there's a steel pipe that runs the length of that well. There's cement around that to ensure that nothing can go from the wellbore to any adjacent layers or into an aquifer. So it's a very safe process. It's been used in over 60 years in over a million wells across the United States.
So what happens when something does go wrong and you have these spills of thousands of gallons of the drilling fluid out onto the surface?
Well, there are regulations in place. States heavily regulate every process involved with fracturing or with drilling a well. So if there is an accident, there are measures in place to make sure that's cleaned up and to handle that. You know, we work very hard to ensure the environmental impact is very minimal.
Because we've had reports of various states of up to 8,000 gallons spilled out into the area. There have been reports of fish dying in creeks and places where the water and the chemicals have impacted the environment.
Right. There was a case, Dunkard's Creek in Pennsylvania, that was blamed on natural gas, and it turns out it was a coal mine discharge. So there are lots of anecdotes out there.
It's not what I read in the other sources. They don't agree with you, obviously.
Well, don't take my word for it then. The EPA under the Clinton, Bush, and now the Obama administration has repeated that there have been no cases of contamination of drinking water from hydraulic fracturing, and state regulators in all the states that have oil and gas development have also made that point.
Well, I'm not talking about the drinking water. I'm talking about the creeks and the spillage that comes out of the site.
Again, as I was saying, there are regulations in place to handle that. If an unfortunate accident does occur, the company's responsible for cleaning that up. Mm-hmm. And that was the case recently in Pennsylvania where there was a spill and it was handled accordingly.
Kathleen, what problem do you have with all of this?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. You know, we've been developing natural gas and oil in this country for over 150 years.
Yeah, so you're
the last 60 of which we've been using hydraulic fracturing with an exemplary safety record.
Gwen Lackalt, you are concerned that we really don't know what's in some of these chemicals being pumped in there.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, I'm a community organizer by training with a degree in political science. And I can tell you that fracturing is a big political issue. And we don't really have the science. And it's turned into a game of he said, she said. And we really do need the science. We need the EPA to conduct a comprehensive study of the practice. And we need to require companies to disclose the chemical constituents that they use in drilling and fracturing fluids.
Well, you mean we don't know what's in those chemicals? What the chemicals are?
That's correct. And industry has for years stood behind what they called trade secrets, and that they don't want to disclose their recipe, if you will, for fracturing fluids. Mm-hmm. And our position is, you know, that's fine. Coca-Cola, the Coca-Cola recipe is secret, but we know what the ingredients are. Those ingredients are listed on the side of the can, and we believe the same needs to be true for communities that face oil and gas development.
What kind of ingredients do we know of? Do we know about some of them?
Well, some of the chemicals are disclosed on material safety data sheets that we've been able to get from our local fire stations, and those list everything from trade names like Zetaflow and all sorts of propants and gels, and that benzene, toluene, ethylene glycol, that those are some of the things that are contained in fracturing fluids.
When you have a hazardous material spill, don't the fire department, don't they like to know what they're going to be cleaning up when they come and clean it up?
Exactly. They need to know what they're dealing with. So a lot of those chemicals have to be disclosed on these MSDS, mm-hmm. material safety data sheets, but those lists aren't complete. And we need to have full disclosure of the chemicals used in these operations so emergency responders know what they're going to be dealing with once they arrive at a site where there may be an incident.
Kathleen, what would be wrong with that, with the disclosure of all the chemicals?
Absolutely nothing, because that's the current case today. On a well site, you have all the material safety data sheets for every chemical that's contained on that site. We comply with all regulations as far as that goes. If you would like a list, everything is disclosed. Pennsylvania and New York State's environmental departments both have a comprehensive list of chemicals. The Groundwater Protection Council, which is a body of state regulators, also publishes a list of the chemicals used. And certainly in the event of an accident, those material data safety data sheets are handed to responders and are on site exactly for that reason. And the specifics are available to regulators who are responsible for ensuring it's environmentally sound.
Gwen, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's exactly why we need to pass a bill that's before Congress today. It's called the FRAC Act, the Fracturing Responsibility and Awareness of Chemicals Act. And that bill would set a federal floor, and it would require that fracturing be regulated and that chemicals be disclosed. And currently, we do not have every state in the country does not regulate the practice of hydraulic fracturing, and we have 32 oil and gas producing states. So this bill would set a federal floor. States are welcome to pass additional regulations governing fracturing.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen, you say that despite Pennsylvania citing the Cabot Oil and Gas Company last February, I'm reading from a Forbes article, for contaminating wells used for drinking near drill sites, you're going to stick with your line that none of this gets contaminated.
Right. There's been no case of contamination of drinking water from fracturing in its 60-year history. And as for disclosure and regulation, all the states who have oil and gas already regulate the process very heavily. If they want to add more laws for disclosure, as New York is set to do, they can certainly do that. But, you know, it's regulated heavily today.
Mm-hmm. Gwen, any final words?
Well, our position is that hydraulic fracturing is an unregulated practice. And in 2005, due to heavy industry lobbying, the Congress exempted the practice of hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And companies are not required to disclose the chemical constituents, with the exception of a new requirement in Colorado. So no one is actually monitoring for contamination. And until we have full public disclosure, we won't know what chemicals to test for when there is an incident. So because this practice is unregulated and we don't know what chemicals to test for, we haven't seen what the issues really are or potentially could be from this practice.
That's just not true. We are subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. We have been since 1974 when the act was put in place. The only thing that we are not is Safe Drinking Water Act does not require fracking specifically to be under a particular underground injection control permit program. But as far as handling the materials at the top of the at the surface and the wastewater, that's all handled in accordance with the Safe Drinking
Water Act. But there's no regulations for underground.
Absolutely.
You're saying that just for the stuff that's above the ground. There's no EPA regulations.
There is not, because the states are regulating it that now, and the EPA under the last three administrations has said that they don't need to regulate it and that it is a safe practice.
That might change with this bill coming up. Who knows? We'll see. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. Gwen Leckholt is the director and founder of the Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project. She was in Durango, Colorado. And Kathleen Scama is the director of government affairs for the Independent Petroleum Association of Mountain States. She was in Denver. Thank you all, and have a good weekend to you.
You too.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with one of my favorite guys. Dr. Eric Kandel is here. He's going to talk about, he just turned 80. Happy birthday. And also is a new film out. He stars in his own documentary film, which is an interesting take. Maybe he's going into the movie business. We'll talk about him. You know, he's won the Nobel Prize, and so there's a lot to talk about. 1-800-989-8255. Vera Kandel up after the break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.
Cities are the largest emitters of ozone, the main ingredient in smog. And across the nation, urban areas have been the ones struggling to meet air quality standards, while rural counties, which emit less ozone, have generally remained below smog pollution limits. But soon, that may no longer be the case. The Environmental Protection Agency this week proposed a tighter ozone pollution standard, and now many suburban and rural areas may be running into trouble with the feds. David Gorn has this report.
Some of the worst air pollution in the nation is in California. In fact, Los Angeles, Sacramento, and Fresno consistently rank in the top 10 of the most polluted cities in the U.S. But if you go up to the far north of the state, in the mountains of Siskiyou County, near the Oregon border, the skies are clearer, but maybe not clear enough.
I don't think we've got the industrial activity and or the population appear to really create a bad situation as far as ozone goes.
That's Eldon Beck. He's sitting in his small air pollution control office up in the town of Yreka. Beck says it's a small operation up here, just him and his boss, who also doubles as the county ag commissioner and the animal control officer. And Beck says he can't quite believe his county may soon be out of compliance with proposed new federal ozone standards.
Well, we're not very excited about that at all.
The current federal limit for ozone is 75 parts per billion. But the new plan is tougher, putting the ozone threshold at between 60 and 70 parts per billion. And that could send many more counties into noncompliance, which could eventually mean the loss of federal dollars, such as highway funding. This comes at a time when many suburban and rural counties are facing budget shortfalls, and many are worried about more expense in a bad economy. But for Melissa Kelly Ortega, living in the town of Merced, at the northern lip of the Central Valley, it might mean that her six-year-old can breathe a little easier.
The valley is actually like a bowl, so our pollution just sits here. In the summertime, what we're dealing with is ozone and smog, and that's really a bunch of different types of pollutants, but then they're cooked by the sun, and so we're kind of sitting in this big pot of pollution soup.
Ortega says her daughter has severe asthma because of it. Asthma and other respiratory diseases have increased as smog pollution levels have risen, says Janice Nolan of the American Lung Association. Sometimes people think of these ailments as mildly inconvenient, but she says they're much more of a health threat than that.
There are actually people who die from asthma. This is the kind of thing where children are turning blue and they end up in the emergency room at night.
But keeping pollutants out of the air is not a simple task. For one thing, smog travels. So, for instance, San Francisco, with its sea breezes, is far below the ozone emission threshold. But its smog blows east into Sacramento, where the terrain bottles up that smog into the Sacramento Valley. Up in Siskiyou County, Eldon Beck says some of their pollution is from forest fires, and some of it likely comes from the nearby city of Medford. So what is cash-strapped Siskiyou supposed to do about that?
Somehow we're going to have to develop a plan, I guess, to try to come into compliance. But it's going to be a big expense all the way around.
Just how stringent the new regulation will be is up for discussion. A series of public meetings will be held this year, in part to decide what ozone level is fair as well as safe. For NPR News, I'm David Gorn.